is now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning, the court's ready to hear argument. Are you ready to proceed? Mr. Nackbar.
Madam Ready, Your Honor. Kenneth Nackbar here on behalf of the appellant. This is an important case. It's important to the parties, but it's also important for Delaware law. There are significant questions concerning standards on appraisal. Price Communications Wireless, or PCW, owns cellular interest in 16 separate markets in the southeastern United States. Petitioners, appellees here, had a minority interest in one of those 16 markets, Montgomery, Alabama. The market was owned by Montgomery Cellular Holding Company, called MCHC sometimes, or Montgomery. The appraisal resulted from a cash-out merger. The court below based its valuation in large part on the price in a proposed purchase of PCW, the parent company that owned all 16 markets, by Verizon, a national wireless company that was trying to fill out its national footprint. Verizon agreed to pay a premium price because the 16 markets together as a cluster filled a significant hole in Verizon's national footprint.
When you say a premium price, what are you referring to? Premium over what?
A premium over what, for instance, a financial non-strategic buyer would have paid. If somebody who wasn't otherwise operating in the industry were to buy this based on a financial buyer, typical financial buyer, they wouldn't pay the same price that Verizon would because Verizon was trying to fill a hole in its national market. They were trying to build a national network. So that's what I refer to.
So the argument in your brief is that this wasn't really a proper comparable because of the synergies.
Correct. And we think that the Delaware law is very clear. Now, the existence of these synergies is not mere rhetoric. The trial court candidly acknowledged that Verizon's price included synergies. In the words of the court, Verizon agreed to a value that implicitly incorporated whatever synergies it expected to realize from creating a national network. But that's what the court found. Delaware law is clear that an appraisal petitioner is not entitled to such synergies, and that's particularly true here, where the petitioner owned a minority interest in one market, and the synergies were created by Verizon acquiring a cluster of 16 separate properties. And that strategic value is well established in the record. It's not disputed. Petitioner's own expert admitted that the single property in which plaintiffs had an interest, Montgomery, would not fill the hole in Verizon's coverage area the same way that the acquisition of 16 properties owned by PCW would. Yet the court based its valuation in significant part upon the Verizon price, which included those synergies. Now, the trial court did not quantify those synergies in any way. Academic studies of the industry, which we presented, showed that those synergies could be quite significant, as much as 25%. The strategic value to a particular acquirer, such as Verizon, could be even higher. But instead, the court held that Montgomery had certain favorable or allegedly favorable demographics compared to some of the other 15 PCW markets, making it more valuable than the average market. Now, the court reached this conclusion despite unrebutted testimony that precisely because of the favorable demographics, Montgomery attracted the most competition and therefore had the lowest EBITDA multiples, the lowest profitability of any of the 16 PCW markets. That was true even after the court fully accepted all of the upward adjustments to PCW's EBITDA, I'm sorry, to Montgomery's EBITDA, urged by petitioner's expert.
What is the legal significance of that point? That is that the Montgomery property had lower EBITDA than the other 15 or 16 properties?
Well, I think the problem is this, Your Honor. What the court did is it took these synergies that it admitted existed, that it never quantified, and it said I don't need to quantify them, and I can still rely on the Verizon price because this market was better than the other markets, and I assume those two somehow cancel each other out. I don't think that a court can take something as significant as 25% of the value, never quantify it, and assume that something else that might cut in the opposite direction, which is also unquantified, somehow cancels that out without ever quantifying either of those. And I think it's particularly bad because, as petitioner's expert explained matters, favorable demographics can lead to a higher value for three reasons. Results in more customers, more revenues, more profits. Montgomery didn't have more customers than other PCW markets. Its penetration rate, which is a measure of the number of customers that are signed up as a percentage of the population.
Are you making an argument that the court was factually wrong in allocating a higher value to the Montgomery property that would have offset any synergies?
Yes, I am. I believe that that's not supported by the record, and more importantly, the court didn't quantify it. The right thing to do here, I think, was for the court to quantify the synergies. They admittedly existed. They're clearly not permitted by Delaware law. What the court should have done is it should have quantified the synergies and backed them out of the Verizon price.
Excuse me, how is the court supposed to do that?
That's a very good question, Your Honor. I think that there was expert testimony that the court could have relied on, but if the court didn't find the expert testimony before it to be convincing on the quantification of synergies, it could have required the parties to come back and present additional testimony about the synergies. Alternatively, the court could have appointed its own expert precisely to value
the
synergies.
Okay, what I'm trying to get at is this. In reading the court's opinion, I at least came away with the impression that the court paid careful attention, didn't really like what he heard from your expert, wasn't perfectly thrilled with what he heard from the other expert either, so took a whole bunch of information and tried to weave together an appropriate result. And you're appealing and saying, well, you know, the court didn't back out a certain portion of this value and allocate it and specify how we came to that number and so forth. Is that really required of the trial court in an appraisal action? Isn't it sufficient if the court looks at the evidence that's presented and says, okay, I'm taking a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and I'm applying, you know, my judgment as to whose analysis is more accurate or more reliable, and this is the number I come to. You know, why does it have to be parsed down the way you're suggesting, the way a financial expert would do, as opposed to a trial judge?
Well, I think your Honor's observation is a good one, and I think within reason, that's a fair way to approach things. If you're talking about a dispute as to 2%, 3% of value, if you're down to the fine point, valuation is an art, it's not a science. There is not a correct, precise, right number. On the other hand, we presented third-party studies of this industry showing that the synergies of a cluster, not the value to a particular strategic buyer, but the synergies themselves, are as much as 25%. In the case that Vice Chancellor Strine decided, I think it's Union, Illinois, he found in that case synergies were 13%. You add on top the specific value to a specific buyer, and you're talking even greater numbers than that. You're talking about huge differences. You're no longer talking about, you know, $500,000 or 2%. You're talking 15, 20, 25% or more. And I think there is some obligation on the part of the court to try to quantify those. That quantification may not be precise. It may not be down to the dollar. But you've got to at least make an effort. And I think it really shows up here because the valuation that was based upon the Verizon transaction was clearly an outlier. If you look at petitioner's own expert, what he came up with for the Verizon transaction, the value based on that, was $199 million for the operating assets. There were also some non-operating assets that were added on. About, the court found them to be $20 million. So you've got essentially $200 million. The value that petitioner's own expert attributed to Montgomery based upon comparable transactions of a similar size, $136 million. The value as a result of petitioner's own DCF analysis, even taking every assumption that the petitioner's expert made into account, was $150 million. The value of the so-called cellular dynamic settlement that's discussed in the party's papers, without adding a premium to offset the so-called settlement haircut. If you just look at that settlement itself, it translates to a value of $152 million. If you look at the metrics from the Verizon transaction, undisputed, that was based on 13.5 times cash flow. If you apply that multiple to the cash flow that this company had after all of petitioner's adjustments are accepted, you get $161 million. So the Verizon value of $199 million was an outlier. It's 25% or more higher than the other values arrived at by petitioner's own expert. I'm not talking about our expert. I'm talking about their expert. And it was an outlier because it included impermissible synergies, which not coincidentally have been recognized in the industry to be on the order of magnitude of 25%. Inclusion of this outlier impermissibly inflated the value arrived at by the court.
Now, is your position that these synergies were unique to Verizon and that there would be no other entity that would have achieved similar success by overpaying, in a sense?
Well, I want to be clear. There are two types of synergies that are at issue here. The first is the synergies from having 16 markets together as opposed to one. And even a financial buyer would realize those synergies. Even if General Electric Capital were to buy these, 16 together are worth more than one alone. And those are the types of synergies that are discussed in the studies, the third-party studies that we cited for the court. I understand the court didn't like our expert, and he rejected our expert's testimony, and I'm not here to argue about that. But there was evidence in the record, there were third-party studies of this very industry that quantified those synergies. That's the combination of having 16 together. Beyond that, yes, this did have a unique strategic value to Verizon, and there's certainly no evidence that any other acquirer had the same hole in its national network. I mean, I don't know about Singular's national network, but there's certainly no evidence in this record that they had a need for properties in the southeastern United States, and, you know, similarly with the other players.
So your point is that someone would have paid more for 16 than they would for one, because when you had anything to begin with, it would be better to have 16 than one. But if you were a person like Verizon and they would fit into a gap in your market, then you'd pay even more.
That's correct.
And so my question is, was there anyone else in the world similarly situated to Verizon? And as I understand your answer, it's not.
As far as this record is concerned, no, I'm not here testifying as an expert. I can only say what's in the record. In the record, no. Now, the other problem, and I do want to save some time for rebuttal with the Verizon transaction, is it was an option. It was not a transaction that was expected to close or could close. It was conditioned upon an IPO by Verizon. Verizon could proceed with that IPO or not at its sole discretion. It was only obligated to go forward if it believed that it could do an IPO on terms that were acceptable to it. It was a purely subjective standard. What happened, it's undisputed, between the time the deal was signed and the time of this cash out merger, it was about a 7 or 8 month period, the wireless market declined significantly.
Well, how without using up all your time, address a recurring theme we have in these appraisals. Now, this is another situation where the vice chancellor said he wasn't persuaded by either expert, and he had to come up with basically his own valuation. And we've written many times about the expertise of the Court of Chancery. Assuming everyone brought to bear whatever they thought would be helpful, and you decided not to pick either one that came up, as he did here, where did he go wrong other than what you've mentioned so far? That he didn't qualify, you know, make the qualification that you wanted.
Well, that is huge. I mean, he went wrong in numerous respects, but most significantly, he went wrong by not quantifying in any way the synergies. And I think it would have been fairly simple for the court to either hire its own expert or call the parties in and say, look, you have not, I'm required under Delaware law to back out the synergies. You haven't told me how to do that. Mr. Gartrell has attempted to tell me how to do that, but I don't find his to be persuasive. Mr. Sherman hasn't even bothered to try. You guys need to come back here. We'll have 2 days of testimony, and you tell me how I back out these synergies. If that had happened, I suggest we wouldn't be here today.
Thank you. And you still have a little bit of 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Martin Lesner on behalf of the petitioners in this action. Mr. Nackbar is correct. This is an important case, but not for the reasons Mr. Nackbar stated. The appraisal that Vice Chancellor Lamb did is entitled to a high degree of deference. I would submit it is a model appraisal. It is based on MGB, the law and the techniques for valuing holding companies based straight on MGB as held by this court. Our expert submitted a framework which was adopted by the court with minimal changes, similar to MGB, valued the holding company, valued the as an operating company, and then as a non-operating asset. Valued the operating company by using a comparable transaction analysis, a DCF analysis, a comparable company, just like MGB. What the court did was evaluated the entire record, and where our expert had suggested a weighting of 80-15-5, the court taking into account the pros and cons of the methodologies and the comparable acquisition, adjusted it so that it was 65-35%.
Well, we're aware of that. What is your specific response to the argument that the Verizon transaction was not the appropriate model for determining value because it included two layers of synergies that should have been backed out?
Okay. There's many answers to that. As a comparable company, first, the issue which they're raising is that there's some sort of impermissible statutory synergy. Well, that's not correct for a number of reasons. The first reason is that this one was not the merger. The statute, 262H, says that you cannot consider value arising from accomplishment of the merger. That's where the synergy comes in. But the merger in this case was the merger of the holding company into its parent, Palmer. In other words, the parent simply took for itself the operating company and then basically sold the operating company. So the merger itself is issue. There was no synergies in the merger of the holding company into the operating company. And if this was a case in where the minority stockholders hadn't been bought out, then the minority stockholders would have been entitled to the value that was paid for the operating company. Same result under 271. So the whole premise of some sort of synergy under the statute is wrong. The Verizon deal was an asset purchase, and what they did was they merged out the holding company, took the operating company for themselves, and then flipped it to Verizon. The second answer is this was never raised in the lower court, and there's a good reason, because it doesn't make sense under Delaware law. Specifically, in our post-trial briefs, we stated, because the valuation of the controlling interest of subsidiary Montgomery, unlike the Union Financial case, there is no issue, nor did respondents raise one, regarding any statutorily prohibited post-merger synergies. And we cited the MGB case, the lower court case by Vice Chancellor Jacobs, in which, in that case, the court explicitly rejected the argument that a control premium arising from a comparative acquisition approach represents post-merger synergies prescribed by 262H. In other words, and there was never any briefing, we put that in our opening brief, there was never any comment. The issue was never raised. The issue was never raised because Delaware law is explicit in that valuing a holding company that when doing a comparable acquisition methodology, that that does not represent post-merger synergies, which are prescribed. The exact same thing was done in MGB, which was based exclusively, the value, on three comparable acquisitions.
So, stated another way, you're saying that someone could pay more for assets because there are economies of scale that can be realized when they're combined with their business, but that's not synergies.
What that is, Your Honor, is exactly what the court evaluated and what was the issue before the court, and that is, in a comparable transaction, would Verizon pay the same amount per pop, $6.16 per pop or whatever subscriber, for buying 16 entities than it would buy for Montgomery as one entity? That was the issue. And the court found that there, and based on a very full record, that there were a lot of reasons why Montgomery was more valuable, and that an acquirer would pay more for Montgomery than it would for 16. The court clearly stated there were no business-related combinatorial value in the 16. The testimony of respondents themselves was that there was no economies of scale in operating 16 as one. What Verizon was buying was subscribers and pops.
And so you're saying, number one, there were no synergies in that transaction, but number two, even if there were, they're not the kind of synergies that are prescribed by the by the appraisal statute.
Absolutely, Justice Jacobs. The record, it was asked of respondents' experts, what was the premium that Verizon paid? He said, I don't know. There's no record that says Verizon paid more for its own particular interest. And as a matter of fact, the record is the opposite. We put forth, in our brief, it's at footnote 14, that this particular entity, Montgomery, was on the outskirts. It had several potential. Only 25% of it was attached to the rest of price. It had several potential acquirers around it. It was more valuable, as the court found, possibly the most valuable entity based on all of the metrics for valuing the cellular industry. It is almost Orwellian that the respondents can come in and say, well, it was actually worth less based on EBITDA, when the vice chancellor himself found that the majority stockholder drove down the EBITDA through what he called corporate charades of stealing, of taking money. So the point is, in any comparable acquisition analysis, what the judge, what people in a business do is they say, is the acquisition really comparable? Would Verizon have paid $6.16 a pop? Would they have paid 13.5 EBITDA for the 16 as a whole? Would they have paid that for the one? And there was a lot of evidence that they would have paid more, that Montgomery was the crown jewel, the most valuable, and that the price they paid for the 16 was an average. The court found that there was no business-related combinatorial value. The phrase that is referred to by Mr. Nackwall when the court said it, Verizon implicitly put in whatever synergies they had in creating the 16, or in acquiring the 16. What the court clearly is referring to is whatever price they were paying to buy, the court explicitly said, whatever price they were paying to buy 16 all at one time, which is the transaction cost, which is minimal in a $2 billion deal, and said eliminating the holdout value. Now, eliminating the holdout value means Montgomery was more valuable because they were able to acquire all 16 on an average instead of paying more for the more valuable entity. And that itself is admitted by respondents in the record.
But what Mr. McBarr is saying is, whether you're buying one or 16, only Verizon would have paid as much as it did.
Well, again, that goes down to whether this is a comparable acquisition. The record, there's no support. His expert was completely rejected, utterly rejected in every aspect. There is no record as what Verizon would have paid or wouldn't pay. We didn't just do the Verizon as a comparable transaction. There were other comparable transactions that were used by Vice Chancellor Lamb. We had a series of five RFA transactions, which the court weighted as part of the comparable acquisition analysis. And in there, one of the, and these were RFAs, which are less valuable than Montgomery, which is an MSA. One of those went for $654 a pop, which was more than the Verizon transaction. To say that Verizon is an outlier doesn't is not true. As a matter of fact, if you, from Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion itself, if you had simply taken the respondent's own expert and had, if he had used the mean instead of the median, his comparable company analysis would have had a value of $183 million for MCHC. And if he had simply balanced 50-50, the court found he manipulated his balance of rural and regional comparables. If he had simply balanced it 50-50, then it would have been a value of $224 million. On the, there's no debate here. They're not saying that there's a synergy discount on the other comparable acquisitions. Theoretically, they should, because every comparable acquisition, then, under their theory, would have to have some sort of, the court would have to determine the synergy discount. They don't argue that for all the other comparables. They don't argue it because it was never argued before. But even take, they admit, on the Cellular Dynamics transaction, which was at $470 a pop. Now, they argue that the court erred in putting off, adjusting it by 15% in their briefs. But even if you don't take that, even if you just take the $470 a pop, put on the non-operating assets, then you're over $170 million for value. And the court found $196. And of course, the court found, well supported by the record, the reasons for the 15% adjustment, that a settlement and an appraisal is not the same as an arm's length merger, and it was a minimal value. And the court was well within its discretion to make a 15% adjustment.
What in the record supports that? The other side says there's nothing in the record. It just sort of developed full-blown from the Vice Chancellor's head.
Well, that's incorrect, Your Honor. That argument is incorrect. There's something. Our own expert report said that there is, our own expert took a 30, added 30% on, but explicitly said that if you didn't add the 30% on for the minority acquisition, you would have to add on for the fact that the stockholders were settling, that the settlement was not a comparable transaction because the stockholders were settling for less because of litigation risk. That was in our expert report, and that's cited in our brief. The court also found that it was a minimal price that was paid in the settlement. That was well supported. There's a lengthy footnote in our briefs about price paying less because this was a minority interest. That's well supported. There were letters that were cited by the court in its opinion that said, we're settling now because we want to get this over with. That this was cited by the court.
Let me interrupt. If I understand at least the thrust of Mr. Nakbar's position, it's that, okay, maybe it's appropriate to add something to the CD settlement when you're trying to reach an appropriate comparable value. But the trial court picked 15% and kind of picked it out of the sky. And if you take that choice and the way the court analyzed the Verizon deal and so forth, these various choices of percentages add up to significant amounts of money when all is said and done. And it's in space somewhere. Nobody said 15%. Now you're saying, well, your person said it should be 30%, so therefore 15% must be reasonable, or at least it's supported by the record. But if the trial court obviously rejected 30% because he didn't use that, right? So having rejected what the expert presented as an appropriate adjustment, where does that leave everybody in terms of the trial court just kind of picking numbers?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe the trial court picked a number that it was based on. The trial court on this issue said that this is not exactly a comparable because a settlement is not the same as a merger, okay? And that a arm's length negotiation would have resulted in a higher price. It also cited extensive record that said that this was the minimal price that was paid, and extensively about how they paid minority interest. The court cited letters that said that the plaintiffs were settling this now for the sake of getting it over.
Right, okay, okay. So, you know, I'm with you that there is record support for the idea that some adjustment is appropriate, okay? What I'm getting at is that having said that, you now have a range that's kind of, well, whatever the judge picks. You know, he could have picked 5%. He could have picked 29%. He picked 15%. He picked it out of his head. He picked a number that he thought was good. That's what I'm getting at, is that when it happens once on a very small portion of the total valuation, you sort of say, well, you know, you got to pick something. He picked something. But when you start adding them all up, it can be disconcerting to have the trial court doing its own valuation without the kind of expertise that is brought to bear by the party.
I understand, Your Honor. And I think it comes down to when doing a comparable analysis, there is a lot of judgment that comes out. An expert may suggest the framework, and in our case, our expert suggested that a 30% adjustment was proper because of similar reasons to what the Vice Chancellor said. Now, the Vice Chancellor didn't accept the 30%, but he said it is because he's fine that it wasn't an explicit minority discount. But he found, for all the other reasons that were in our expert report of why it wasn't comparable, and he picks a range that was halfway. Our own expert has said that within that, I'm not going to add on for purposes of the litigation risk and for the settlement value of settling. I'm not going to add on because it's incorporated within my 30%. And I believe that in any comparable acquisition or comparable company, the judge or any expert, they pick a range and they say, I know that this transaction isn't quite comparable, okay? And it's a good transaction, I can make some adjustment. Now, the court has said, if you adjust too much, it's not comparable. But 15% is well within the range of discretion, supported by the record, and within the range which our expert said. And I don't think it's, by any way, is arbitrary or something that's something that wouldn't be entitled to deference based on this record.
You're saying then that there was a record that would have supported an upward adjustment of as high as 30%, but this is a matter of judgment, not science, and left with no judgment other than your expert. It was within the realm, the range of reasonableness for the court to pick a figure that was half.
Absolutely. And the trial court also found that Montgomery was one of the most, if not the most, valuable entity. And so this was comparing the sale of a sister entity, which was weaker, to one that was stronger. Again, record support for a 15% adjustment between one of the strongest entities and one of the sister entities. So on the valuation front, the Vice Chancellor was solid, and it was well within his discretion and well supported by the record, and the other side has nothing on that front. I do want to emphasize, because I think it is very important, on our cross-appeal for attorney's fees. The choice in this case is very important as Delaware law, and that is the issue of whether, and the issue is very stark. The respondents take the side, the position that even bad faith in setting the merger consideration does not entitle you to attorney's fees.
Unless it's fraudulent.
Unless it's litigation. What they're saying is unless it was litigation, unless the bad faith is in the litigation itself, the setting of the merger consideration in bad faith does not constitute attorney's fees. And our position is, if there was ever a case for attorney's fees, this is the case. And that people, transactional attorneys, lawyers, will be watching this case because what they did was an efficient breach. And the record we've laid out very, very carefully.
Well, at the end of the Vice Chancellor's opinion, he quotes former Chancellor Allen for the proposition that we're going to stay with the American rule even if the conduct is deplorable. And that's the word. So how do we how would you have us characterize misconduct?
Quickly, it is not the standard in an appraisal case. The statute says equitable. It's not glaringly egregious. The statute, MGB, CD, all say it's equitable. Okay? The respondent's own counsel says in a law review article that attorney's fees are available under the statute. Therefore, the standard is equitable. But and this, the case law that was cited was in other non-appraisal cases. The policy, though, of the appraisal case has to be that the appraisal is a full remedy. And it, admittedly, the court found that they set the consideration without consideration for what fair value was, and we lay out in our briefs that they purposefully and intentionally set the price at 2.5 times less. They set it less than the book. They set it less than everything. If this was a pure efficient breach, just because the statute is an enabling statute, all right? But if the outliers are not pointed out and said, this is an outlier that deserves attorney's fees, okay, then there will never be a case where attorney's fees are appropriate, and transactional attorneys will set consideration based on that opinion.
Very briefly, let me talk a little bit about the CD settlement. Your Honor, I think conceded in one of your questions that there was a record that an upward adjustment was appropriate. That's not what the trial court found, and I understand that Your Honor was posing perhaps a hypothetical, but what the court said is, quote, there is an insufficiency of evidence in the record concerning the computation of the CD settlement. That's opinion at 42. So there is not a concession by the court that there's a record justifying an upward adjustment, and the only question is how much. In fact, what happened was petitioner's expert came in and said, under Georgia law, it's a minority value that you get in an appraisal. Therefore, the settlement in that case is different than the amount that you're entitled to under Delaware law, where, of course, we don't have minority discounts. The record was crystal clear, however, that during the pendency of the settlement negotiations in the CD case, a clarifying opinion came out from the Georgia courts, and they said, no, you don't have a minority discount price. It's just like Delaware. And letters were exchanged in which plaintiff's counsel, who was involved in the other Georgia case that clarified Georgia law, wrote to Price's counsel and said, we don't get a minority value, we get a full value. That's why the court rejected the 30% discount or the 30% premium, because the record was crystal clear that whatever else was true about the CD settlement, it was not a minority discount value. There was no evidence of any settlement haircut of what people do. And I represent a lot of defendants, and I know that defendants, you know, they're just as worried as plaintiffs. Plaintiffs are worried that they're going to get less than fair value in a case. Defendants are worried that, you know, the award might be more than what they regard as fair value. There's no discount. There's no premium. That's just the way it is. And the court's 15% was totally arbitrary. There was no evidence from anyone about that. As far as synergies go, in MPM, the court held that it could look to a negotiated merger price to determine fair value in an appraisal proceeding, but the merger price must be accompanied by evidence tending to show that represents, and I may have a garble here, that the value represents the going concern value of the company rather than just the value of the company to one specific buyer. 731 Atlantic 2nd at 797. Subsequently, Justice Jacobs, sitting by designation in Coleman, held that the court could look at market value of an asset if synergistic elements of value are excluded. And there are other cases that we cite. Here, the synergies are undisputed. And Mr. Lesner says, well, but if you had one company and you sold that one company, that would be like Harris versus Rapid American or MPM. It might be. But we didn't have one company here. They didn't go out and sell Montgomery to someone. They sold 16 companies at the parent level, and now they're trying to extrapolate those parent metrics to a single sub. And there's just no record that supports that.
There's no record as to what any buyer other than Verizon would pay, simply a failure of proof. They talk about comparable transactions. There were comparable transactions, the ones that Mr. Lester talked about, but those had values of $105 million to $136 million when you apply those metrics to Montgomery. You don't get to $200 million. That's the problem. It's undisputed that Verizon was filling a strategic hole. It could only do that by acquiring 16, the whole Southwest, Southeast, not one. And that's just undisputed in the record. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Hey, thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we'll take a short recess.
Please rise.